Your Honor, may it please the court, I am going to be arguing for the appellants this morning, and if I may initially introduce my colleagues, first I'd like to start with Catherine Gall and Andrew Cordo of my firm, and also with us this morning are Mr. Seitz and Mr. Anstam representing Mr. Holbrook, the other appellant.
Good morning. Welcome.
Primary issues addressed in this appeal. The first and probably the most important for immediate aspects of Delaware law is whether the depository trust company needs to issue a proxy for the shares that are held by its banks and broker participants, or whether those banks and brokers may now in Delaware be treated as record holders and vote on their own. The second are the issues raised with Mr. Kurtz's purchase of the Boutros shares, and those issues include possible vote buying, breach of contract, interference with contract, and a breach of fiduciary duty by Mr. Kurtz.
Now, if we resolve the first issue in your favor, we don't necessarily have to address the second issue. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct, Your Honor, although we do believe it presents an important question of Delaware law, specifically what is a transfer of stock. We believe it created a new rule of Delaware law saying that, that something that transferred all of the economic interests and all the voting rights, and indeed even the stock certificates is not a transfer.
I understand that, but the premise of my question was, if we ruled in your favor on the first issue, we wouldn't have to reach the second issue, and to the extent we did, it would really be dicta.
Well, Your Honor, I guess that would depend on which the court certainly could rule on the first issue and the second issue, and which would be dicta and which would be a holding, I guess would be up to debate. I would say both of them would be the holding of the court because both of them resolve a dispositive issue.
All right. Then maybe I don't understand the argument in your brief, because I came away with the impression that if we ruled in your favor on the need for an omnibus proxy, we wouldn't have to get to the second issue at all.
I agree, Your Honor, the court does not need to get to the second issue.
Okay. But maybe I do understand your brief.
Perhaps I explained it very poorly here, Your Honor.
There's a third issue you haven't told us yet.
Yes, Your Honor. The third issue relates to the bylaw that my client, Crown, proposed. It was an amendment to the bylaws that would reduce the size of the board to three and have a special meeting, and it was enacted.
The Crown bylaw.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Let's go back for a moment because, there was a large portion of the writing of the opinion that addressed whether or not the CD breakdown should be deemed part of the ledger under Section 219. Is that issue subsumed in your issue number one?
Yes, Your Honor. That is my shorthand and for that. And I believe, in fact, Your Honor, is...
But they're actually two separate issues, aren't they?
Your Honor, it depends, I think, on how one reads the opinion. I think what the court below held was that the CD breakdown, henceforth, will be considered part of the stock register for Section 219. That's clear. There is also a potential issue of whether, if one puts that aside, whether the vote of the CD vote should count in any case under a prior dicta of the Court of Chancery. I believe, in fact, that when one reads through it, one comes to the conclusion that the Section 219 issue is the controlling issue, and that without 219, the court below would not have arrived at that. What the court said, of course, is, and it acknowledged that this is a change in the law, that for present purposes, because of the way the evolution of the CD system and the federal securities laws was, that the CD breakdowns received by companies should be considered as part of the stock register under Section 219. Now, that, of course, is a change in our law because never up until now have we accepted that a CD breakdown is part of the stock register. Thus, never up until now have banks and brokers listed on the CD breakdown.
You're using the term register. I thought the two operative terms were stock list or stock ledger. Am I missing something?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It is stock ledger. It is a stock ledger and the stock list. The stock register is a term used in some of the cases, and I think it is the same as the stock ledger. Now, we have never, into this point, right, in Delaware, said the CD breakdown list, the banks and the brokers were record holders, were registered holders, and could vote by themselves if they held through CD. Rather, they always had to get some sort of proxy from CD, whether the normal omnibus proxy or whether CD itself would write a consent or a proxy card on their instruction, which also can be done. The court below said that is no longer needed, and we ought to get beyond that. As such, we submit that that is a change in the law. We think it's very clearly a change in the law. It has never been done before. And we believe that should be left for the General Assembly.
Well, let me ask you this. The way you framed the issue is whether it is legally necessary for CD and Co. to issue a proxy, that is a physical piece of paper. A physical piece of paper evidences an authority relationship. It isn't the relationship. And according to the record, as I understand it, it is undisputed that CD always issues a proxy or otherwise authorizes their broker participant members to vote the shares that are allocated to each of the brokers. So in those circumstances, why does it matter as legally whether or not this piece of paper actually was distributed?
Well, I think it matters, as Your Honor, because as proxies do matter. For the same reason, banks and brokers do not, under federal law, have any authority to go against the wishes of their owners. Yet, under the holding of the court below, a bank or broker would be allowed to issue a proxy here or sign off on ADP. But if there is no proxy authority there indicated, the court below, I think, would say there's a problem.
As far as I understand it, there has never been a case where CD has refused to authorize its brokers to do whatever brokers normally do, which I guess is obey the instructions of their beneficial owners and vote accordingly. So if we were to conclude that as one of the cases has said, that the actual CD omnibus proxy is a formality, is it necessary to get to any of the other issues, including the issue of whether or not the CD breakdown is part of the stock ledger?
If it is an unnecessary formality, and if the court decides that there is no need because that relationship is known for a proxy to be issued, the court, I believe, could say that. But then I think the court...
I'm sorry, is the answer yes or no?
I apologize, Your Honor. I believe the court could say that.
Could say what?
Could say that it is a needless formality.
Okay, and if we did, does that dispose of the issue regarding the voting rights or the entitlement of the brokerage firms to vote the shares that are allocated to them?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
We need to get to the second issue.
You would need to get to the second issue because banks and brokers are then in the same relationship. They get instructed by they are the same as CD. They are instructed by their clients, the individuals who hold the stock or the hedge funds or whoever holds the stock. And there would be no reason to treat the beneficial holders as any differently than the first step up we treat the banks and brokers. If we say...
Well, if the proxy had been issued here, the depository brokerage firms would be doing whatever they normally do, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if the proxy, as occurred here, did not physically issue but wasn't necessary, there would be no difference in what the brokers do. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So if we conclude that there was no legal requirement that a physical piece of paper called an omnibus proxy be issued, what does that you know, what follows from that in terms of the counting of the votes that are held by the brokerage firms?
I think what follows that is then the next question, Your Honor, is why can't the beneficial holders put in their own proxies? Because as the banks and the brokers
well,
are
the
not...
The reason is that they're not holding of record. Isn't that right?
I mean, the banks and the brokers don't hold a record.
But they're authorized, at least under the hypothetical that I've just framed.
But
they're authorized by the record holder, which is Citi.
But the banks and the brokers, while authorized by the record holder, also have the same relationship. They always must authorize the voting of the beneficial holders. They're required by federal law.
Let me phrase the question differently, because I'm having real trouble understanding the relationship between your arguments and what we really have to decide and what we don't. If a physical omnibus proxy had issued, would that be the end of the case as far as that side of the vote is concerned, or would there be another layer of analysis that we would have to go through?
If there was a physical omnibus proxy here, Your Honor, assuming that everything's right with it, that would take care of the issue.
And if the physical omnibus proxy, as here, wasn't issued, but we were to conclude that it didn't matter, why would there be any difference in the analysis?
What I'm saying there, Your Honor, is the analysis, if the analysis is Citi doesn't have any discretion over the matter, therefore we don't need to see a proxy because we can assume as a proxy. Then, by logic, it doesn't stop there. The banks and the brokers don't have any discretion, and therefore we should not need a proxy from them. Their beneficial holders should vote. It doesn't stop with Citi. The discretion in the whole system lies only with the ultimate beneficial holders.
But you've got that same problem even if there were an omnibus proxy issued.
No, Your Honor, we don't have that problem now because the rule is the record holder votes. And so long as the record holder is the one voting.
But Citi is not voting. All Citi is doing is authorizing the brokers.
It is giving a proxy, Your Honor. All right. And then the banks and the brokers give a proxy down to the beneficial holders.
And in either case, they would do that.
That is correct, Your Honor. But the banks and the brokers can vote without an omnibus proxy. Why should the beneficial holders need a proxy from the banks and the brokers? Because haven't we then said that henceforth the beneficial holders are the ones who can vote under Delaware law rather than the two chains up? I believe the same logic applies, Your Honor. I don't believe we can escape that logic, and that we would say there would be direct voting of the beneficial holders. And, of course, the beneficial holders are largely known by corporations these days because of NOBO lists.
Am I correct in understanding that what you're saying, in essence, is that if at the CD level it's okay to just pass it down because we know that's what CD is going to do anyhow and, therefore, we don't need a piece of paper, then it would have to follow that we would be holding, in essence, that the same thing is true for the banks and brokers.
Yes, Your Honor, stated much better than I stated.
But why can't we draw a distinction between those two levels? Because at the bank and broker level, they are getting instructions from beneficial owners, whereas at the CD level, CD is just passing it down. It's not really getting any instructions at all. Isn't that a distinction or
that,
not?
That is a distinction, Your Honor, but why should not a beneficial holder be able to directly vote rather than go through the system where they don't know whether, in fact, their instructions are followed or not, which is, of course, one of the debates right now about this in the federal system, is very often you vote. Does that vote pass through? Well, maybe it does or maybe it doesn't. And then you started getting to other things on, well, how many shares do the banks and the brokers actually own because of short sales and others? There are numerous problems with that. What I would submit is the current system works. The current system has been in place since the end of the 1960s. And there is no need to get rid of a proxy, the omnibus proxy, because it does work. And I would submit to the court it would be a mistake to change that system in the belief that, well, the new one probably will work, when we don't know that for a fact. And there is no compelling reason presented here or that would say, let's change the system. Let's get rid of the omnibus proxy. And I think we also have the fact that not only is this system...
Well, we're not really changing the system, are we? Wouldn't the ruling simply be that there's no need to have physical evidence of authority that's going to be issued automatically and ministerially in every case?
I think that would... It would certainly change the way voting was conducted because there would no longer be a CD omnibus proxy in cases of Delaware corporations.
There would be a CD omnibus proxy. There just wouldn't be a piece of paper to evidence it.
There would be a CD list, but it wouldn't be the omnibus proxy with the omnibus proxy language. It would be, I believe, Your Honor, it would be that change. But I would submit that even if one doesn't go directly to the record point and if one stops there and says, this is just a change, I would submit it is also a change that affects X, the statute, and our understanding of the statute. And I would submit that it is a change that should be made by the General Assembly. The General Assembly has been well aware of how the system has worked for 40 years. We have statutes such as 231, which address the multi-layer system, where the General Assembly has dealt with the fact that there's a multi-layer system and where you can get evidence. They address the fact that there can be a record holder and then banks and brokers. I specifically mentioned in 231.
Mr. Jenkins, are you going to spend any time on your argument about reducing the board down to three?
Your Honor, let me just address that briefly. We believe that it's clear under Delaware law. In fact, it is clear that under Section 109, bylaws are presumed to be valid. And this Court said that in the CA Inc. versus AFSCME case. But it also says that in Section 109. Bylaws are presumed to be valid. Bylaws are to be construed consistent with law, if at all possible. That's Franz versus EAC. Bylaws must be read together. We have 3.1 and 3.11. They must be read together and cannot be read separately, that 3.1 does this without looking at 3.11 to see what it does. The fourth is bylaws are to be interpreted in light of the facts at issue and not some hypothetical set of facts. That's, again, the CA case. And the next is that directors have no vested right to serve out the remainder of their term, Chesapeake versus Shore, the Chancery Court's decision. And when those are considered, what the court below did is the court below looked and said, there are a number of hypothetical problems here, specifically a hypothetical problem of, in other circumstances, you could have a problem with a quorum, but you don't have a problem with a quorum here. If this was allowed, then perhaps directors could remove other directors. Our answer is simple, independent legal significance. No, they couldn't. This is shareholders taking action that would have the effect of removing directors. It's a hypothetical. Then the court says, well, we look at the issue of you've removed or reduced the size of the board and there's a gap of 3 weeks between then and the special meeting electing the successor directors. Those two bylaws can be read together and read in conformance to the law to say that that takes a place, the reduction in the size of the board takes place as of the special meeting.
Why doesn't your argument that you made on your first point, that that's a change for the General Assembly to make, apply equally here, that the General Assembly says a majority of the shareholders entitled to vote can remove a director? But that's not what this bylaw does.
This bylaw doesn't remove a director, as we understand removal. What it does is reduce the size of the board, Your Honor. And as the court below held, you can do that. court below said you have to wait for an annual meeting because we know you can reduce the size of a board. There's no question about that. And we're not removing a director. We're saying there's only going to be one director instead of three or four, or whatever it is. That isn't a removal. That is a reduction in the size of the board. It's a doctrine of independent legal significance, Your Honor, bedrock part of the Delaware corporation law. So we're not asking for a change in the statute. And, Your Honor, I see my time is running short, so with the court's permission, I will allow my friend to address the court.
May it please the court, my name is Joel Friedlander. I represent the appellees for the stockholder plaintiffs Donald Kurz and Sims Diversified Value LP, the newly seated directors Lloyd Sims, Philip Cleveno, and Michael Koenig, and the third party defendant stockholder Take Back EMAC LLC, known as TBE. I'd like to introduce the court. Mr. Sims is here today, one of the newly seated directors. I'd like to pick up on this, the question about the CD, about the stock ledger and the CD breakdown. I'm afraid my friend is mistaken about the relationship of how these levels work. Automatically, CD transfers voting authority to the DTC participant banks and brokers. It not only has no discretion not to do so, but it will do so upon being notified that it knows that a contest is taking place and a record date has been established. It will issue the omnibus proxy to the company, give the piece of paper to the company, assigning voting power to the banks and brokers. They have to do it. They're required to do it. And we quoted an SEC release in order describing that process. Two conditions.
Mr. Friedlander,
yes.
What you just described happens as a matter of course. And according to the vice chancellor in this opinion, it should have happened as a matter of course in this case. Somebody should have done it. He wasn't allocating blame to anyone for not getting it done. But isn't the legal issue we're grappling with here attributable to the fact that someone didn't do what they could have easily done? It fell through the crack, and now the question for us is, what effect is that going to have on Delaware law?
I absolutely agree with you, Your Honor. And if I could just explain a little more further. When the vice chancellor said it happens in the ordinary course, is that if you have a publicly held company in which the securities are registered with the SEC, then in order to comply with the SEC proxy rules, to run a proxy contest, to run a consent solicitation, there are required communications with DTC. DTC becomes notified and in the ordinary course issues the omnibus proxy.
No, I understand.
Okay.
But our court is presented with a legal issue.
Yes.
Because someone in this case didn't do what everyone else has done for many, many years, and they could have easily done it in this case. They just didn't do it. Is that right?
That is right. And in particular, DTC was not, they weren't informed, for instance, even though this was a publicly announced solicitation by the company, where they're soliciting revocations of consents, and even though they set the record date, and even though CD owns, holds 4 million out of the 7 million outstanding shares, the company never advised that CD of the record date for the solicitation.
No, I understand. And that brings me to my next question. You know, we could clearly rule as you argue in your brief, this is a formality and we ought to change the law and recognize that it's a formality. But we do have all of these other cases to consider where we say if you're the beneficial owner and you don't have the stock in your own name and it gets confused to your detriment, that's unfortunate for you, the beneficial owner, who decided not to hold it in your own name. So what are we going to do with those cases? Because that's what happened here. The beneficial owner chose not to hold the stock in their own name. Somebody didn't do something that could have easily been done, and now the court is asked to come to the rescue of the beneficial owner who, according to all of our prior cases, assume the risk of confusion.
I would submit, Your Honor, there is no prior case of this court addressing the relationship between DTC and the DTC participant banks and brokers in the voting context. I think the only case that addresses it is Olson versus Buffington.
No, that's why my question was record owner versus beneficial owner.
Right. So the issue we have here is not the ultimate beneficial owner, and I think this is where my friend is mistaken. The banks and brokers do not issue proxies to the ultimate beneficial owners. The record's actually clear. They get voting instructions from the beneficial owners. The banks and brokers, they'll give a proxy to Broadridge. That's why there's a one piece of paper, Broadridge, that votes all the shares. So the voting, the actual person who voted here was Broadridge on behalf of all the banks and brokers. So this is the only case that deals with that situation. This is the only, so we never had a prior situation that this court has never dealt with in the voting context, the relationship between DTC and its participant banks and brokers. I submit to Your Honor, there are three separate statutes that compel the conclusion that the omnibus proxy document is a mere formality and it can be disregarded. And those three statutes are 219C, for the reasons articulated by the Vice Chancellor below in the construction of stock ledger. Secondly, 228A, which refers to holders of stock. It does not refer to stockholders of record on the stock ledger. It refers to holders, and it was construed by the Court of Chancery in Olson versus Buffington and has never been amended since. And third, the third statute is Section 225, because Section 225 authorizes the Court of Chancery to make any order that is just. Section 227 elaborates that one of the orders that the Court of Chancery can make in a 225 case is who can vote shares under claim of ownership.
Well, Mr. Friedlander, just a predicate question. Did the Vice Chancellor rule that the omnibus or city omnibus proxy was legally unnecessary or not?
He ruled it was because he ruled that the CD breakdown was part of the stock ledger.
Right. And why then was it necessary for the Vice Chancellor to address the issue of whether or not the CD breakdown should be deemed part of the stock ledger? Would it be would it not have been dispositive for the Vice Chancellor just to stop after ruling that the omnibus proxy, physical omnibus proxy, wasn't a legal requirement?
Right. There's an introductory part of the opinion that's just saying I'm following Olson versus Buffington, saying that this proxy document is unnecessary.
So is the 219, Section 219 ruling dictum?
In a sense,
or is it an alternative ruling?
I think it's an alternative basis, because you could follow Olson versus Buffington, which the statute mentioned Olson versus Buffington was 228. Because the question under 228, who may consent? There was a prior unpublished decision by Vice Chancellor Brown in Grinberg saying that only people on the stock ledger can consent for purposes of 228. Then Vice Chancellor Berger said in Olson versus Buffington that, well, for the purposes of shares held by a bank and broker held through a depository in which the depository is identified, that bank and broker may execute a consent itself.
Well, you know, Mr. Jenkins is making the argument that this is something the legislature should address, and there's discussion in everyone's brief about the amendments in 2003. If you look at the amendments to 220, clearly the General Assembly knows that there are beneficial owners that may not be record owners, and they made changes in 220, but we don't see the same changes in 219.
I think that helps our side, Your Honor, and let me explain why. Because I think the authority to consent comes from Section 228. So ultimately there's the question of what a holder is. Who's a holder for purposes of 228? 219, by its terms, does not apply to written consents. 219 says we look to the stock ledger for purposes of who's entitled to get a stock list under 219 or to vote in person or by proxy at any meeting of the stockholders.
Well, how do we reconcile that with the concept discussed in our prior cases that the stock ledger is something that's within the control of the corporation. The corporation doesn't have the CD breakdown. That's something that it has to obtain. And so the implications are, in this particular case, somebody has to count the votes. They counted the votes using historical practices. They said, we have votes here from people that aren't on the ledger. Those votes don't count. And your argument is, oh, but, you know, the ledger really isn't what you're looking at. The ledger incorporates by reference the CD breakdown.
Well, I don't believe this court has construed stock ledger since 1956 in the McGill case. And the McGill case said that stock ledger is used in a broad sense. Now, this is the pre-depository era. And said we take a broad view of what the stock ledger is. It's all the records of all the transfers and voting stock, non-voting stock, everything that's ever happened.
But hypothetically, if we take out the intermediary and the corporation's just counting its votes, what we say is we need predictability, especially when it comes to votes. And predictability is what's within the control of the corporation. And the CD breakdown isn't within control of the corporation, is it?
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. And I think that the Vice Chancellor did a very good job of explaining that the CD breakdown is required by federal law to be made available to the corporation promptly upon request. Corporations, as a matter of routine, request it. Under RB Associates all the various 220 cases about CD breakdowns, the CD breakdown is actually deemed to be in the corporation's possession at all times because it is immediately available as a matter of law from CD. And that's in federal law 14A D 8B. Requires that what a CD breakdown is, a position listing, and the factual record, it's conceded by their proxy solicitor that the CD breakdown is substantively identical to the omnibus proxy. It lists the same parties and it lists the number of shares. It's an identical document. It just doesn't have that last page saying we confer the power to vote on the banks and brokers. So I would submit, Your Honor, as a matter of federal law, as a matter of Court of Chancery abundant precedent, the CD breakdown is considered to be in the corporation's possession at all times. It's immediately available upon request.
Could that be done by contract when items are put in street name, put a proxy as part of that boilerplate so that this issue never comes up again?
Well, the way it's done by contract, and this is interesting because I think this you know, we never really had a case that really discussed the depository system as the Vice Chancellor did below. The decision is actually made by the company. The company decides it wants to raise money in the public markets. The company decides it wants to be DTC eligible. The company enters into a contract with DTC in which the DTC states in that contract, we will supply you the omnibus proxy after the record date, upon the record date. So when we talk about the choice, these very old cases about the choice of the beneficial holder, in the 30s, maybe about 10% of holders held through street name. It could be a choice you could have to hold through street name. It is literally impossible today for corporations to access the public markets unless the great bulk of those publicly held shares are held through the depository system. And the DTC banks and brokers have no choice. They are part of the DTC system because of a federal policy and a federal statute requiring the immobilization of stock certificates, or else the public security system just could not function. So so in terms of those policies, I think the court Chancellor did an excellent job of explaining that history, also explaining how the CD breakdown provides that certainty and reliability, and that says the only public policy at stake is the policy against disenfranchisement, where you say because of whatever odd reason, for some reason, that piece of paper was not transmitted. Not only was it not transmitted, but for some reason wasn't presented to the court. President, how would you know if a CEO decided to throw away the omnibus proxy and therefore said, oh, we don't have it? Who wins then? How would you ever find out? Because if you just need that piece of paper to be presented to the inspector, if that's the ultimate requirement, that really throws into jeopardy the legitimacy of elections. Here, 15% of the common stock outstanding voted through Broadridge, through their banks and brokers, to replace and elect new directors. And it's because the company announced this solicitation, set the record date, but didn't tell Seedy, who owns holds four out of 7 million shares, 4 million out of 7 million, didn't tell them the record date. That if they had done so, the document would have been issued. Even on the last day when they were reminded, hey, we don't have a DTC proxy, they didn't request it and didn't tell us they hadn't requested it. So I think it really jeopardizes the legitimacy of our law and the policy against disenfranchisement to say you have to be able to produce that piece of paper and give it to the inspector, which the soliciting stockholder never sees. CD only sends it to the issuer corporation. And so it's this breakdown in the system, and I think there are three statutes that are already on the books that support the result reached by the vice chancellor.
Can that breakdown be remedied by a breach of contract action, or at least compensated by a breach of contract action?
Well, but it's the contract between whom and who. See, I would submit, Your Honor, it's actually what 225 is all about, is the equitable discretion of the court to say, to count the votes, to determine who may properly count the votes. And there's a relationship between the beneficial owner and the record holder. Look at that relationship and see who controls the voting of the shares. Because ultimately, this is decades-old law, at least dating back to Chancellor Walcott and Giant Portland Cement. Ultimately, voting rights do not come from the stock ledger. Ultimately, the voting rights come from the owner of the shares. And that's why there are cases going back a century saying that the record holder cannot vote contrary to the wishes of the beneficial holder. And if the record holder does so, the beneficial holder can come to court under 225 or its predecessor statutes a century ago and say that those shares should not be counted against me. I control the voting of those shares. And I think that principle applies perfectly to this situation where we have the clear expression by the DTC banks and brokers of how they vote based on voting instructions they received. And because of a mere formality, because DTC, for whatever reason, did not issue the piece of paper to the company, and that piece of paper was not routed to the inspector of elections, those shares otherwise wouldn't count. So under 225, 228A, or 219C, I think we can prevail on all three statutes, or any of the three statutes that are already on the books. If I could turn to, very briefly, the Boutros shares, because those are the only other shares that are at issue that would create the margin of victory. There was nothing in either of their briefs, there was no argument made today, any discussion of vote-buying case or any case under any doctrine about invalidating a vote based on these facts. And the facts we have here is a contract between two stockholders in which the court was found, there was no use of corporate resources, there was no use of inside information, there was no fraud on the seller, there was no antagonistic interest or personal interest by Mr. Kurz in entering into that contract. That contract, moreover, is not even in the record. They're invoking a transfer restriction that is not in the record. There's an unsigned excerpt of a purported agreement.
Well, that didn't trouble the vice chancellor. And it is the case, is it not, that the contract, the excerpt of which is in the record, precluded a transfer of the shares. Is that right? As distinguished from a transfer of an interest in the shares.
Yes, Ron, I agree with the second part of your question, not the first. I think it did trouble the vice chancellor. The vice chancellor did not find that there was a stock restriction, a binding stock restriction. The vice chancellor assumed arguendo. He said, I'll assume the contract exists, but then I'll find no violation. You did not find the contract actually exists.
Well, humor me for a moment.
Yes.
Assuming that for purposes of argument that it was a binding transfer restriction, we're confronted with the argument that for all practical purposes, there was a transfer of the stock because there was no interest remaining, that is, that continued to be held by Mr. Boutros other than the bare legal title. What is your response to that?
I respectfully disagree in two respects. One, I believe Mr. Boutros retained the right to the dividends. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, is that the company retained an interest in the shares because these were unvested shares that wouldn't be fully vested for another a year from now. So that if Mr. Boutros was terminated for cause, if he resigned, if the company went bankrupt in the interim, those shares would never be issued to Mr. Boutros. So Mr. Boutros had a future interest in those shares. He was transferring a future interest in those shares contingent on him ultimately getting them in 2011 and being able to transfer them. So it was a contract of a future interest.
Except the voting rights were a present interest.
Yeah, and that's the way the security was created. So the company, and they issued these securities, they issued them with voting rights, but assuming these restrictions, you know, they were to vest one-third per year, and even assuming these restrictions are binding, they could take the shares back at any time for those first 3 years if certain conditions happened, such as if Mr. Boutros resigned, if he was terminated for cause, and if the company went bankrupt, he would never issue the shares in the interim. So this was a transfer of a future contingent interest. It was a contract to transfer a future contingent interest or an interest in the future. And that is an economic interest. Because the economic interest was transferred, it is by logic and law and appropriate that the purchaser exercises the voting power as the residual risk bearer. But there was not a transfer of shares because Mr. Boutros didn't hold the shares completely. And I want to make something absolutely clear. There's a lot of talk about this resale restriction agreement about 25,000 shares. Those shares are not at issue in this consent solicitation. Those are shares that did not vest until after the record date. They are not part of the 50% plus that allowed my clients to get elected. And their briefs do not distinguish between the two. There was a much more broader contract entered into just a couple months ago to tie up those 25,000 restricted stock units that contained prohibitions against transferring an interest, contained prohibitions against entering into a contract to transfer, contained a prohibition against transferring the risk of economic ownership in the shares. All those three prohibitions are not contained in the excerpt respecting the 150,000 shares of restricted stock, and that illustrates why transfer by itself should not be construed so broadly to envelop all those other things, especially since stock transfer agreements under Section 202 have to be written to be enforceable.
I was talking to Mr. Jenkins about whether that this issue would be moot if we resolve the first issue in his favor, and as the argument has evolved, especially in light of what you said, I assume your position would be it wouldn't be moot, because even if Mr. Jenkins prevailed on the first issue, you'd probably want to marshal the votes for another contest, and you need to know whether these shares can be voted or not.
I put it a little bit differently. Actually, for our side to prevail, to have the 50%, we need both. We need the publicly held shares that were voted by Broadridge on behalf of the banks and brokers, and Mr. Boutros' shares.
Well, so exactly, but
for this particular contest, yeah.
Yes, but I think if you want to revisit this particular contest, since we now know it's pretty easy to get an omnibus proxy, it's a question of doing what you should have done with regard to the omnibus proxy. This is all hypothetical, but you would still need to be able to vote Mr. Boutros' shares too, so that's an issue that would not be moot.
Right, but I think it's very critical about who was properly seated as of December 21st, because things changed. That, you know, that for instance, the other 250,000 shares vested, these restricted stock units. I mean, it's not just important for a future contest. It's important to know, for purposes of this past contest, what board was actually seated.
All right, but tell me your bottom line on whether this issue of the transfer is going to be moot or not if Mr. Jenkins prevails on the first issue.
If he prevails on the first issue, then our directors were not seated. So I think technically it is moot.
Okay.
Your Honor, if I can proceed very briefly to the Crown issue. I think the essential fact about the Crown consents is that the board set up a race about whether the Crown consents could be delivered prior to our consents before our deadline, December 21st. Because they chose to set up a race, by conflicted directors, to set up a race and allow, not set a record date, so the Crown consents couldn't be delivered until a subsequent date. By not setting a record date, they allowed the Crown consents to be delivered immediately so that the Crown won that race on the 18th. And the position of Crown throughout has been because they delivered those consents on the 18th, there were only a three-person board. There's only three spots on the board, and therefore we could not elect directors on the 21st. So because they said there are no vacancies, we could remove directors, but we couldn't replace them. And that's critical because they're saying there's an immediate elimination of directorships. They can say in the briefs, they can say today, oh, the actual directors would not leave until there's a special meeting if necessary in the future. But according to their own logic and their own arguments and their own positions, there was an immediate elimination of directorships on December 18th upon the delivery of their consents. Five sitting directors, according to them, only three directorships. We submit that's contrary to 141B. In two precise respects. The one provision in 141B that says the number of directors shall be determined as fixed in the bylaws, which would be just contradicted because we have five sitting directors and a bylaw saying there's only three. And secondly, the quorum rules, which are based on, quote, the total number of directors, which has been construed to mean directorships. And you cannot have quorum rules if you can just declare there to be three directors when there's really five sitting, because that would mean under a majority quorum rule, which we have in this company, two out of three would then be a majority of a quorum under their rule, even though there's five sitting directors. And that just illustrates how you can't, a minority would become a majority because they're saying the number of directorships can be below the number of sitting directors. We submit that's contrary to 141B. 141B does not allow you to reduce the number of directorships below the number of sitting directors. And I think that is the unavoidable problem with the Crown consents, is that under their reading, under their logic, under what they argued, there was an immediate reduction in the number of directorships such that our clients couldn't get elected.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, on the Boutros point and what he received, I can refer the Court to page A277 of the appendix, which is the purchase agreement. And I believe that document shows that Mr. Boutros received everything, including dividend rights. I don't believe there's any question about that. He received all economic rights. And the Court below specifically found, that Mr. Boutros received all economic rights. The only thing that he didn't get is a name change on the stock register. He received, he said, we've put in where he tried to get the stock certificate, which Mr. Boutros doesn't have yet. Mr. Kurtz received from Mr. Boutros. He tried to get the stock certificate, but Mr. Boutros doesn't have that yet. He received everything up to a name change on the stock register. Now, and we said in our brief, and say again, if that's not a transfer, the only thing that is a transfer on the stock register. And I believe that changes the understanding of what transfer is among practitioners on who knows how many different transfer restrictions exist out there. It is a significant change, and it tells everybody how you can just get around the word transfer.
So you're saying the Vice Chancellor made an erroneous finding of fact on that particular point?
No, I'm saying his finding of fact is correct. His finding that everything was transferred to Mr. Kurtz from Mr. Boutros. I'm saying that it was an erroneous holding of law that didn't constitute a transfer, Your Honor. Now, on it came up on how there was no omnibus proxy here. We know that Mr. Long, their proxy solicitor, professional proxy solicitor, said it was his duty to get the omnibus proxy. We know he put in paper to get that. We know that paper didn't have a record date on it. And, of course, you can't issue any kind of stock list without a record date because you don't know the date. We know he never went back to supplement that. We know that the group, the Mr. Kurtz's group, talked multiple times about this, as their interrogatory said. And that's all we know about what they did, because everything else was wrapped in the attorney-client privilege, and we've put the cites to the record on that. They put in no evidence at trial for why they failed to get the omnibus proxy. There was no evidence on their part. But they come here today to say, well, it doesn't really matter, or that we're really innocent. And they didn't put in that evidence. We think they didn't because they hadn't made up their mind on what the record date was, but we don't have evidence of that. All we have is the instructions not to answer. Questions between Mr. Kurtz and the proxy solicitor were deemed to be privileged. It was a very expedited proceeding, 3 weeks long. Those battles couldn't be fought over whether that was a proper a claim of privilege. But what it means is they cannot say today that they were innocent and they should there should be some redress for that. I think the courts holdings over the years clearly says as that we have to draw a hard line, and the hard line is says that if you hold through a bank or a broker, and you vote isn't counted because if something goes wrong with that system, then we don't look at that. But even if that wasn't the law, their decision to put all their conduct and why they didn't call up DTC and say, where's the omnibus proxy? Their decision not to put that in and to keep us from looking at that, that prevents them from claiming innocence today. They also say that Section 228 should be interpreted differently from voting on a normal vote, and it should allow our votes without the the record holder of DTC. We think that's foreclosed both by 219 and 212. 212 treats them pari passu. We also believe that the language of 228 itself says you have to be entitled to vote. And as Chancellor Allen said in Spicer versus Baker, that phrase, entitled to vote, has a specific meaning that is well known and well applied by the courts. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.